Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we have Kara Dodds Fitch back on the show to talk about her book, Mitchell and Trask's Hedwig and the Angry Inch, out from Routledge. Kara Dodds, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Andy. Lovely to be back.
Yeah, you're our first repeat guest, so I feel like that's something of a milestone.
Do I get a gold star?
Absolutely. It's in the mail. So this book is part of a series called the Fourth Wall series from Routledge, which I've seen described as sort of like the 33 and a third series, but for plays and musicals. So how did you get connected with Routledge, and how did you kind of get the idea for this project?
I've been admiring this series for a while. It's still a relatively new series, and I think when I was reading some of the books in it, the one that initially caught my eye was Catherine Love's book on Tim Crouch's An Oak Tree, which is a piece that I've written about before. So I was teaching a class in dramaturgy at NYU, and I thought, oh, I'll use Catherine's book as a companion piece to, we were studying Tim's work. So, and then I just became super interested in the series, and I am a big fan of the 33 and a third series. And so I was like, oh, this is just like that, it feels like, you know. But I didn't know if that was my hunch or just true. So what I did is I emailed the senior editor for the series, Ben Piggott at Routledge. And I was like, hey, Ben, we haven't officially met, but I really love this series and I'd love to write for it. And can I pitch you some ideas? And he emailed me right away, and he was like, oh, this would be awesome to have you in the series. So it was kind of like a very easy ask in a weird way. And then I pitched him about five things, because I wasn't sure what, you know, they plan in advance, and I wasn't sure what they were after. So I pitched a bunch of stuff. I pitched like plays, but I always wanted to write about Hedwig. You know, I love the show so much, and I thought I'd write a long form essay some years ago, and then it never happened. So I just put it on the list, kind of whimsically, because I actually didn't think they'd say yes to that one. I thought they'd, you know, go for something a little more, I don't know, serious, I suppose. Although I think Hedwig is very serious. So and then I got an email right back, and Ben said, I totally want you to write about Hedwig. And I was like, yay. So it was like serendipitous. I mean, it was like something I've wanted to write about for a long time, getting the yes from Routledge. And then I had a very, you know, we put it into motion right away. We signed the contracts and I got to writing, and yeah, it was pretty easy breezy on that end. And it makes me, and also I've written all sorts of things, obviously. And I've also edited and co-authored books and stuff like that. But I never actually, for real, just sat down and kind of said, this is like my book and here I go. And so it was also a dare to myself. I really wanted to figure out if I could do that. Even though they're little books, I don't mind that they're little books. And I also thought it would be a chance to do the kind of writing that I sometimes save for for essays, like on HowlRound or American Theater, and stuff. I didn't do it in a different form. So it was like a really exciting project to dive into. And in some ways, I felt like it wrote itself.
Yeah, when I just look at like your CV, it makes me tired. I feel like you're doing so many things all the time. Do you like have a daily writing practice? Do you write every day, or you know, do you write kind of project by project? Like, what's your kind of workflow?
My workflow depends. I don't have a daily writing practice. I mean, I do. Twitter is my daily writing practice. And I think email is my daily writing practice. But I'm not one of those people that does like big journals of stuff with full of notes. I take notes when I think I'm going to be writing a play or a book or whatever. And so that's how that happens. Sometimes I get like ideas for stuff and I'm like, oh, that should be in this form. Like 2 months ago when I emailed American Theater Magazine, I was like, I feel an essay coming on. I feel an essay coming on, you know, and because sometimes that happens and I wake up and I'm like, yeah, an essay has to happen today. And so sometimes it's like that. And sometimes people ask me, like HowlRound last month asked me, can you write something for us? And so I was like, oh yeah, sure. Like there were ideas that I'd been teasing out in the American Theater essay that I hadn't I wanted to reformulate. So there's stuff like that, but really it just depends. Like right now I've been writing like a play a month this year, which is a little bit unusual.
Yeah, even for you, that's a lot.
For me, that's a lot. And three of them technically are commissions or adaptations. So that requires a different headspace for me. And then the other is my stuff. So now I'm embarking on something new that it's mine and kind of just fiddling really, but trying to locate what the shape for it will be. I know it's going to be a play of some kind. How it materializes, I'm not sure yet. But teasing out ideas that I've been kind of developing from the other works and trying to find a new form for them. And in the middle of all this, the film that I co-wrote, that it's based on my play, Fugitive Dreams, is premiering at the Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal later this summer. So suddenly, you know, kind of labor of love project is kind of having a premiere, you know? And so I'm having to sort of, part of my brain is also thinking about like, oh, should I be writing a film right now? Should I be writing another film or should I stick to the land of play? So yeah, so I'm in that place a little bit of like probably trying to do several things at once, but also to answer your question, one thing at a time. That's how I work best. And I have always one thing at a time and then a couple of things on the back burner that I'm stewing and brewing and then trying to make space for. And when I'm writing a play, I try to just carve out that space and write until I get to the end. And then if I have like strict deadlines on stuff, I'm very good about turning stuff in. I don't think I've ever missed a deadline. So I like to kind of, when I have a deadline, I like to get it done. I usually like to get it done early. So you know, I try to pull the, what is that trick Simon Stevens talks about where he says he has a deadline and then he turns it in to himself 2 weeks early so that A, he feels super accomplished and B, he can then look at it for 2 weeks after he's written it. So I sort of work in a similar manner. I kind of like, there's a deadline and then I kind of go, how can I turn it even earlier to kind of then be able to sit with it? Because I think the process of sitting with work is really important because it gives you critical distance. But you also have the beauty and joy of following an idea through and getting to end of play or end of book or whatever you're making.
My college playwriting professor was Ken Urban, and I once finished a play and I sent him a draft, and then I sent him like another draft like later that day, and then another draft 2 days later, and he eventually emailed back and was like, you know, I'm happy to share my thoughts about your work, but maybe just let it sit for a while before you send it over.
I know. Oh my God. Totally.
Yeah. So getting back to this project, your book about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, I rewatched the film of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, the film adaptation also, which is directed by John Cameron Mitchell.
Right.
And And I was struck simultaneously by how, I mean, it came out in 2001, and it's both incredibly ahead of its time and incredibly of its time. When you first saw Hedwig, I think you saw it in 98, did you feel like you were seeing something out of the future?
I think I was seeing something that spoke to the past, like, because of the cocktail that is Hedwig as a theater piece. Like, it's, you know, it's recalling 70s glam, also 70s glam UK, but also 70s glam and punk New York, and it's kind of pushing it into the 90s to late 90s. It felt like an interesting fusion. In terms of the future, I just felt like it was, I think what's indelible about the piece is that it's, and one of the brilliant things about it is I think that it's completely unsettled in every way. So what I think what I gravitated toward just originally was that it was like super, it was like, it's very much a musical. Like, it's, and I think sometimes people forget that, and it's like, it's totally a musical. And so it has things about it that are very conventional in a way, but it's also like cabaret theater, and it's also like what we would call a gig theater these days. And it's also just an incredible vehicle for a performer and for performers, you know, but I think centrally for the performer playing Hedwig. So I think that it felt like a beautiful fusion of a lot of things, and also a kind of calling back to a sort of a different time in New York and a different time in the world. So I feel like it sits in a very interesting place as a piece of theater. And also, in fact, in terms of its pointing toward the future, certainly in terms of thinking about how we think about genderqueer identities, in that sense, yes. But I think that because the piece is so specific in terms of its story, I think it troubles that arena in an interesting way. So it was just like galvanizing and super dirty and kind of crummy space, and you know, and I mean, the original space it was done in, it was just super divey, and the vibe was like a divey vibe, and it felt like you were like at a like, where am I? What concert is this? And who is this person? And you know, so I thought there was something a little bit audacious about, and smart, I think, about the way it was originally presented and how it's transformed over the years into a glossier, I suppose, product, especially the Broadway version. But it's also, I think, the film is such a beautifully strange time capsule. It's also like
the hair and the costumes are so 2001.
It's so 2001, but it's also like John refining. Like he had performed the show so many times already, you know, so he was refining some stuff from all the different performances and kind of, you know, obviously solidifying it on film. And it's just so, I think it was it his first film? I'm trying to remember. It might've been. So it's also him, sure. I think it's him as a first time filmmaker. Cause I think after that he did the sex film and then did Rabbit Hole. So it's also him as a first-time filmmaker, which I think as a first-time film, it's a kind of a brilliant to be able to handle all the different tonal things that are happening in that film, and also the visual vocabulary that the film employs is really exciting.
Yeah, it's I love first films. I feel like they're like all often the sort of charm of a filmmaker trying to figure out how to do shot composition, how to direct actors to act on film, especially when they're coming out of the world of theater. I think that's often so exciting. And I feel like this is a really exciting first film too. And you kind of get to see John Cameron Mitchell allowing the story to kind of breathe a little bit in the expanded space that you're allotted through film.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it's also the songs take on a different tenor because they're not live. And so where we understand them as music videos, you know what I mean? And in terms of that format. And I think they, you know, John does a good job of, in the film, of trying to make it feel like it's live. Like he's trying to capture some of that in the energy of the movie. But yeah, but it's tricky because I think there are things about the, for example, the ending of the show that on stage, it's pretty galvanizing. And I think on film is, but in a different way. I find the film very mournful, actually, mm-hmm. and mysterious. Whereas I think in the theater, the last sort of 10 minutes or so are electrifying and you're kind of just pumping your fists and, you know, and you just feel like the world's going to break open and hooray and like whatever's going to happen. So it's interesting because I think the film does a very, I think an interesting dramaturgical choice of actually leaving us in a place of profound ambiguity with the material. I think that's a very brave, it's a very brave ending in the film. And I admire that immensely. It also made me rethink, obviously in writing about it, made me rethink about how the play works as a piece of theater and how the journey that the play sort of charts, you know, how do we reckon with it over time? It's one of the luxuries of like theater pieces that last for a long time is that you get to kind of see how it moves through time, but also how that singular story, which is a very unique and idiosyncratic story, sort of survives multiple rereadings and multiple viewings and listenings.
So speaking of how the piece kind of moved through time, it premiered, well, it was first workshopped, I think, around 94, and then finally premiered in 98. And it was very much a kind of New York downtown show. I don't think it actually was on the Lower East Side, but it was certainly felt like a Lower East Side piece. Right. Could you describe kind of where the scene was at that time?
Oh, the scene was, you know, it's Giuliani is in power as a mayor. Giuliani's a mayor, and the city was really changing. We're sort of on the cusp, really, of a lot of things that we're going through now, actually. This Hedwig came out of workshops at Squeezebox, which was a rock and roll sort of drag punk bar at Don Hill's. So Don Hill's sort of converted into Squeezebox on certain nights. So it came out of a scene of looking at drag through the punk movement, which was kind of a new thing. And so I think that it was sort of looking at a different kind of rebellion. You know, in the book I talk about how do we reclaim the commons. And I think that the part of that, the piece and where it was coming from and how it sort of premiered and what it was speaking to was actually about that reclamation. Which I think is one of the reasons I think it remains an exciting piece still in all its weirdness, because it is trying to reclaim a sense of unstable, unsettled, restless commons where everyone is allowed basically to exist. So I think that it serves that function in terms of downtown. I mean, it premiered at the Jane Street, which was a converted ballroom, basically, at the Jane Hotel. That space later was used a couple of times for some other shows, but it didn't, I'm not sure what happened. I don't know if it was real estate, but it didn't quite survive. But certainly Hedwig was what put it on the map. So, yeah, and it was just like super queer and super fun and really, it was like an event, you know. It was like you felt you weren't going to the theater, you felt you were going to an event. So I think in terms of recalibrating an audience's response to a show, it sort of captured the idea of going to a concert, you know. And I think that in a different way than something like Rocky Horror, which has a whole kind of cult following, I think that, you know, Hedwig sort of functions differently because I think it's you feel like whoever's going to perform the show as Hedvig is going to guide the sort of vibe and the tenor of how the piece works, right? So within the structure that John has given in the libretto and Stephen has in terms of the lyrics and the music. So I feel like there's something in you're taking the energy of that performer, which I think is different from other shows where the libretto is not so singularly centered on an individual. Right. So
it's almost a one-man show.
Almost. A one-person show.
Yeah, one-person show, right.
One-person.
Right. Yeah. So speaking of kind of the multiple interpretations that whoever that central person is, do you have any idea like how many different leads you've seen in the show?
Oh my heavens, I've seen many. I mean, I saw John, and then I saw Michael Cerveris do it in LA and also in New York. I never got to see Ally Sheedy do it, and I'm kicking myself because I read those reviews, and also because I was just fascinated by the idea of having like a female, a cisgender female perform that piece. So it was like a really fascinating thing. And I know at one time Sandra Bernhard was floated, you know, they asked her to do it and, you know, and that never happened, but man, I would have in my head, I would love to see that production. And I know that Lena Hall has performed it, instead of taking the Itzhak role. She has performed Hedvig and so I've never seen Lena do it, but I have seen it around the country, like in Columbus, Ohio, and, you know, in Houston, and like, you know, so I've seen it in other configurations in a much more kind of like smaller theater situations, and which has been exciting because I think it kind of merits. I think once the show was kind of a thing and it had a name and it was everybody was doing it, which is awesome, trying to find those productions that were less glamorous or less official in a way, even though they were licensed, was harder to find. So I saw a bunch of stuff, you know, regionally with the show, just as a fan and as somebody that knowing that, oh, I'd like to write a book someday. You know, that was sort of in the back of my mind. I'd like to write a book someday about this. And I'm taking sort of notes in my head about how that's going to happen. And then, so I think that part of it has to do with filtering all of that when it came time to the writing of the book, like it's sort of like, oh, I've sort of witnessed a lot of different versions of this with bigger budgets, with little budgets, with medium budgets, and with different kinds of performers, but also performers of different shapes and sizes in the role. I always go back to kind of the first time seeing it because the imprint was so strong, and also obviously the film is sort of a record of its own. It has its own identity and it lives forever because it's film. So revisiting that and compare it to the show. And of course, listening to the various cast albums that were done, but also the covers record, Wig in a Box, which has some really interesting cover versions. So just been living with the piece for a long time and also thinking about how it sort of reconfigures itself every time that you view it and that you even listen to those songs. You know, their songs are so well built and they just kick in and they just hit your heart. And there's no denying them. So I think it's kind of like a perfectly constructed series of songs in terms of just the dramaturgy of the plot and barely smartly done.
So I won't ask you the very obvious interviewer question following up on that. I won't ask you which has been your favorite Hedvig, but I will ask you, what are some aspects of that character that you feel like have been revealed to you by different interpretations that you've seen?
The first word that comes to mind is a kind of selfishness, you know. The character, I think that people forget that this character, unless they re-encounter the character, they forget that the character is very kind of well, is deeply wounded, right? Like physically, but also like emotionally. Mm-hmm. So that there's a tremendous armor to this character, and that the performer has to play with. And I think that I've seen some performers be more vulnerable, right, within that armor, and I've seen some performers be completely steadfast in as being as guarded as possible and in wearing the mask as tightly as possible with this character until the kind of stripping and the reveal happens toward the end, and the defiance of that character. So I feel like that color sort of comes up. I think there's also a sort of a mischievousness to this character, and the fact that it's written built in that it can be improvisational, so that there are jokes that are written in, but there's also room for the performer to elaborate and deal with the audience and kind of figure out how they're gonna like sit in somebody's lap and talk to them, and like, you know, so there's stuff that depends on how improvisational the actor is, right? Some actors are less so I think they have more stuff sort of pre-scripted on their back pocket, and other performers really know how to work a room and figure out how they're going to play with the audience. So it's such an elemental nature of the show. So that sense of mischief and that sense of trouble, that's part of it. Also, I think vocally, I've heard like some performers be much more, you know, rock and roll about it, like super rock and roll about it, and leaning more toward the punk element of the show. And I've seen other performers be, I wouldn't say Broadway because that feels like pejorative, but more like, you know what I mean? Like more kind of like I'm doing the song and I'm hitting the notes and I'm doing the thing, you know? And so I feel like, so, and I've seen people do that, you know, where they're kind of delivering the material well, do you know what I mean? But without that kind of the roughness and the grit that you actually need to, I think, perform this music and to understand where it's coming from.
I understand that you're a legend of the avant-garde, but there are many people who would not consider it an insult to be told that they sound like they could be on Broadway.
No, I mean, I think that...
No, I understand what you mean, though. You can do it in a more rough rock and roll way, or you can do it in a more polished, you know, musical theater.
Polished, yeah, it has to do with polish, yeah, and it has to do with phrasing, and it has to do with the cadence of the material and allowing it to not be on the note every time, really, basically, is what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to talk about the question of gender in the piece. Hedwig has often been described by critics as a trans woman, but John Cameron Mitchell rejects that and says that Hedwig is a genderqueer character with a gender all her own. Why does that distinction matter in the context of the show?
It matters because I think that the identity of the character, the sex change operation is a forced sex change operation. I mean, you know, Hansel goes along with it, but because he wants to get married and get out of the East, but East Germany, but there's the enforced nature of that means that the character is not consenting or willing to be transformed. So there's sort of the root of trouble in that show is very interesting and kind of obviously dislocating. The fact that the sex change operation is botched then becomes a whole different animal. Do you know what I mean? It's like Hedwig is neither born biologically male, transformed but not transformed fully, and is left in an in-between state, right? And a completely in-between, but also like an anomalous state, a kind of freakish state. Yeah. So I think that there's in terms of literally, you know, the vagina is closed instead of open. So I feel like there's the characters put into, I mean, a lot of the show is about, you know, this person trying to figure out, well, who the hell am I? Who the hell am I now? What am I going to do with myself? And like, how am I going to reckon with what has happened to my body, right? So, and I think through that, there's also the psychological story that's being told. And through that, Plato Symposium and thinking about the idea of third sex and how does third sex exist, and a character sort of trying to figure that out for themselves, but also realizing that there's actually nobody like them, like just on a physical level. So I think that that puts the character in a very unique space. And rather than somebody who's willfully transitioning, who identifies initially as trans feminine, like that's not necessarily true in this case. So I think I agree with John, obviously, you know, I feel like this is a gender of one, and therefore, there are no other Hedwigs in a way. So, but I think that it's an interesting template to think about the construction of gender, of course, and its performances. And then I think what happens when you get performers in this role is thinking about, well, what is the gender of the performer playing the role? How do they identify? You know, and then that kind of factors in. So I think that there's a lot to weed through and wade through with the role. And again, you know, sort of circling back around to all of that is that because if we're going to accept the nature of the story, which is kind of like a very strange fairy tale, you know, that this character is forced into a situation, has to reckon with that, and then through that actually finds themselves in a way, and starts to kind of heal and acknowledge who they are, who they could be. I think that's like a beautiful journey. And I think the unsettledness of that journey, the restlessness of that journey, makes it, I think, still a beautifully revolutionary statement about fluidity and about not accepting categories and you know, being your own unicorn, you know. So So I think there's something kind of like, I think that's why the show is very emotional for people and why the Hedheads exist, you know, sort of the fans that follow it everywhere. It's like there is something in the material that is truly aching, you know, but it's also kind of getting at something very powerful about forced identities and forced binaries and looking at the possibility and potentiality of, well, maybe there's just like, what if we break through all of that and not decide to choose, but live our own reality or whatever that reality may be. So I think there's something super powerful, and I think still, even today, transgressive about that idea that this show, you know, in its own playful way, taps into.
Yeah, I think that moment is so fascinating when Hedwig's husband leaves her after they go to, I think it's Kansas together, that, you know, after he leaves, there's nothing really preventing Hedwig from, you know, going back to presenting as male. And yet that's not the choice that she takes, but she does kind of further transform. There's the first transition that's sort of, you know, on the level of biology and on, and, you know, kind of, she becomes this housewife in a trailer park. But then There's also the second transformation into the Hedwig that we see at the beginning of the show, which is this sort of, you know, New York Dolls version of punk drag, which is a form of self-creation. You know, even if the original, the sort of first transition is somewhat coerced, the second one feels very much like this is now her.
Correct. Yeah. There's a choice there. And I think the choice is the beginning of the journey, right? For Hedwig to figure herself out. Which is very exciting. I think, and there's also, you know, I think within all of this, we're looking at things like marginality and who gets to be marginalized and why, and where does queerness exist? And, what is the notion of the outsider in society? And one of the smart, again, one of the really brilliant and smart things that John does in the libretto and in Stephen with the lyrics is that this is a character that's continually marginalized. So marginalized by experience and marginalized by being, you know, in terms of being in America from another country, you know, at this moment, you know, a white character. So that's one of the things that doesn't trouble it so much. But still, I think the unseated and unrooted gender of this figure, presenting as female but actually being unicorn, kind of like just destabilizes everything. So I love the sense of disorientation, dislocation that it allows for, honoring and uplifting marginalized spaces and respecting their, I would say, alienness, and I mean that in a positive sense.
Yeah, she even compares herself to the Berlin Wall, saying like, I'm between East and West, between man and woman.
Right.
I'd love to talk about the song The Origin of Love, which you briefly mentioned. This song is a sort of, you know, unfaithful recreation of Aristophanes' sort of story about how, where love comes from, where this desire for human connection comes from. Could you talk a little bit about what makes this song so special in the context of the show?
Sure. I mean, it's the first big ballad. So just on a technical level, you know, after we've been kind of like, oh, what's going on with this play? We suddenly get a moment to sit with Hedwig. And it's presented, of course, it says, it's very funny. I mean, it's the
and
bedtime
beautiful.
Story. And beautiful. Like, but, you know, the funny part of it is, this is what my mom used to read to me when I would go to bed. And I'm like, really? Your mom read you a symposium? Like, that's awesome. So I think the frame for it is like, oh, you know, it's just this kind of household I was in. Right. So and I think through that, it's the idea of where are these the different sort of the male-male, female-female, thirds, and then, you know, male and female, right? And so that's how it's presented, right? The children of the sun, the children of the moon, the children of the earth. And then through that, this notion, what I think is interesting is that the symposium is used as a way to talk about how love can take you anywhere, which is also a line from the show later on. And it's also about, like, how do we know what the origin is? I mean, one of the beautiful things, of course, is that all in the origin of love, the figures, these sort of children, these different children are looking for their other half, right? So, and of course, what happens
they've
in the
play split in half by Zeus.
They've been split in half by Zeus, right? So,
with his scissors made out of lightning bolts.
Of course, just of course, yes. They are. And so, and then it's like, well, Zeus, God figure, why was Zeus doing that? You know, I think there's an interrogation around the divinity of asking humans to go on this journey. And will we find love through that? And I think that's sort of a fascinating and strange and haunting and it kind of eternal, the eternal quest, I think, folks trying to sort of figure out, will they find the half that was separated from them? And I think that within that, in terms of the dramaturgy of the show, is also that this is a figure that is also looking for their other self, for the self that they left behind, for the self that they might have become. So the other half is not just a romantic coupling, but also your own kind of personality. How can you find your wholeness, your completeness? And I think that's actually a very, it's one of the things about that song that if you return to it as a listener, kind of hits home. And actually sets the ground for the rest of the play. The song comes fairly early in the show, but actually it drops us down right. It kind of clues us in to know that we're not just in for tear me down, things are messed up, here we go, it's awful. Oh, but actually, let me tell you about how this all started and how maybe all of us has started. And I think it opens up to talk about all of humanity in such a beautiful way and using symposium as the method, right? Sort of using it as the vehicle, sort of a slightly warped retelling of the symposium, but a beautiful one nonetheless. And I think also in the original production, the use of animation and that, and kind of crude drawings, so that it's sort of evoking the kind of images that Hedwig sees in their mind. Just put it in the realm of like, oh, we are all dreaming the story, and this story is all of us. So I sort of love that about the show, and I think that it's kind of it also gets us. I mean, you know, part of this musical is dramaturgically is also a creation myth. So how do we, where do we come from? How do we create? Who do we become?
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's so fascinating about this is that the bedtime story could have been Socrates' speech from the symposium, which is all about how love is this beautiful, ennobling thing that helps us to perceive the form of the good. But the story that's chosen is Aristophanes' story, which locates desire and love in this sort of primordial wound, which feels very Hedwig-ish, perhaps.
Yeah, and it's also like, this might sound a little bit odd, but I think it kind of validates the dramaturgy of the play, right? You know, it sort of says, let me use Aristophanes to kind of seat this material, mm-hmm. which I think that for an audience, you know, it's funny. It's like every time I've seen the show, I've wondered like, I wonder if people know who Aristophanes is. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think it also opens up this idea of like, what are the figures that we're calling forth to enable our storytelling? And in this case, going back to the ancient Greeks, but the choice of Aristophanes, you know, also being the mischievous and provocative choice as well. So I think that is also like a layer, an intelligent layer that's sort of grafted onto the dramaturgy.
Yeah. Finally, I'd love to ask you about what do you see as the influence of Hedwig over the theater of the last 20 years? Are there children of Hedwig that you can identify roaming around Broadway or off-Broadway or off-off-Broadway?
Children of Hedwig. Let me think for a second. I mean, you know, Lord. I think in a weird way, I mentioned it in the book sort of slightly, but and it functions completely differently from a dramaturgical standpoint. But I always think of Passing Strange as somehow being related. Only because I feel like, A, it's another rock and roll show. It's also dealing with the pansexuality. It's also partly set in a kind of demi-monde setting. It's also investigating identity and origins and what those mean. You know, I think the thing about Passing Strange is that it's so much about Stu, right? It's autobiographical. So I think it in some ways has, unfortunately, I think in the history of American musical theater is a piece that because of its autobiographical nature has not allowed it to actually have more productions, more reconfigured productions in a way, because mm-hmm. the original Broadway production got shut down. While they were trying to install a new person to play the lead, and to take on Stu's onstage persona. So I always think about a missed opportunity there. And I think that I wonder what would have happened if we brought that show back, and how we would look at the pansexuality in that show now, especially through the lens of race. I'm trying to think of like other shows. I mean, certainly Strange Loop. I don't think Strange Loop could exist in the way that it does, without Hedwig kind of knocking down some doors. And again, doing it in a very different way, right? As sort of mm-hmm. doing it through race and performance and the history of musicals and who's allowed to say what, when, and why, and where do you exist and who is marginalized and which voices and which bodies. So I feel like Strange Loop benefits from Hedwig being there before in its own in its own strange way. I haven't seen, you know, I'm trying to think of like shows that deal with, I've been kind of a mildly aching, maybe I'll have to write it, mildly aching for a show that looks at, well, two things. I've been mildly aching for shows that look at the punk rock movement through the female lens. I feel like that's a story that's not really told, on, at least in theater that much. So I've sort of wondered what happened to that story since it's very much part of history. And I've also thought about like, you know, the character of Itzhak, in Hedwig is such an interesting character, multi-identified. But the idea of a drag king, the idea of the drag king persona leading a show hasn't really happened yet. So I'm waiting for that to happen. Waiting for that to happen. Yeah. You know, because it also, I think that it's kind of like a realm, especially at the level that Hedwig functioned at. I mean, it's certainly originally, I can't imagine that when they opened 1998 that they thought it was going to be a blockbuster. Do you know what I mean? Because it's a weird show to begin with.
It's a weird show.
You know, it's like, it's a weird show, and it's like, you don't know that thing is going to fly and it will catch on. But it did, right? So again, a bar has been set, something's been laid down. So it feels like more could be built on top of that. And and it's interesting to me that I feel like truly, again, super unsettled pieces haven't kind of emerged entirely from that particular musical dramaturgical bedrock in a way, but some have.
I feel like one, I don't know if there's an influence story to be told here, but I certainly feel like when I was in college and I saw Taylor Mack's show Lily's Revenge, I certainly had a frame of reference for that show because I was sort of like, oh, it's sort of like Hedwig. It's sort of like Rocky Horror. And it's obviously a very different thing. And it's so steeped in, you know, critical theory and Elizabethan comedy and all the things that that show is steeped in. But it does feel like Hedwig is perhaps one of the ingredients in that stew.
Yeah, and definitely a gateway. Like for people that were like, how do I apprehend what Taylor Mack is doing? Oh, well, I have a, you know, if you don't know anything, you could at least go, one of my gateway drugs has been Hedwig, right? So you can sort of walk into that world and go, oh, I think I sort of know what Taylor's up to, even though it's very, very different.
Mm-hmm. And those are important. I feel like, especially for young people trying to find their way in the world of culture, I mean, having those shows that can kind of open that door is essential.
It's huge.
Well, Caridad's Fitch, thanks so much for coming on the show to talk about Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I enjoyed your book so much, and I hope this podcast will encourage people to check it out.
Please check it out. It's also like a deeply personal book. I keep saying that, you know, so I'm just going to say once more time for the record that it is kind of like one of the things I wanted to do with the book is make it feel like you're reading a little novella. So it's partly about me as viewer and audience in person and also a certain time in New York, how New York has changed. It's about the downtown. It's about uptown and what those things mean, and it's also about the reclamation of the commons. So I feel like inside of it are these other things, that it's not just a dry book about like, let's look at every song in the show and let's look at, you know, even though I do do that.
But it's very much your experience of the musical is foregrounded.
Oh, absolutely. And also Bowie's passing and the specter of Bowie looms and largely over the book. And how could it not?
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for being on the show. And we'll be sure to have you on, you know, the next time you have a book project, you know, next week or 2 weeks from then, something.
Oh, my Lord. I'll slow down. I think I might have a book, but it won't happen until next year.
Fantastic. All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much, Andy. Thanks for your time.